Hello, and you are listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM, the News Collective's weekly news report bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs coverage from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. My name is Alex DeBoer.
I'm Gary Jarvis.
And I'm Samuel Jones. It's Thursday, December 20th at 5.03 p.m. We're broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkamedam-speaking Musqueam people. We'll be starting the show off with a story on Vancouver's 2019 property tax increase as part of the city's new budget. Property tax rates were set to increase to 4.9% for 2019. While this increase was described as unfair by some property owners, it was considered just by many others. Well, at City Hall for the budget debate on Tuesday, December 18th, News Collective member Alex DeBoer spoke with both pro- and anti-property tax increase protesters holding signs up in City Hall chambers. Next, we're going to hear a summary on the long, long day of debate, questions and amendments that preceded the passing of the Vancouver 2019 budget and capital project spending this past Tuesday. We'll then turn to coverage of question period held on the city's recent task force report on the overdose crisis and the recommendations this report made. So first, let's hear about Vancouver's 2019 property tax increase.
TR's News Collective.
At large.
Is that too short?
No.
At large.
From CITR's News Collective. Lola, why don't you try it?
Sick. You're listening to At Large. From the News Collective at CITR.
Hi there. Thanks for listening. My name is Alex DeBoer. At 9:30 a.m. on Tuesday, December 18th, Vancouver City Councilors began scrutinizing Vancouver's 2019 budget. Sitting in the top gallery of City Hall chambers were people holding signs, signs specifically objecting to an increased property tax rate of 4.9%. The signs appeared to be the same ones, or nearly identical, to the ones held up in chambers to protest the provincial school tax just last week. And for a bit of context, both taxes are exclusively on property value rather than, say, income, though the provincial school tax only applies to properties valued over $3 million. It's important to note that municipal governments get most of their funding from property taxes, and in Vancouver's case, 55% of its budget and operating revenue comes from property tax. The mayor said this year the property tax increase was greater than usual to account for inflation, additional investments in infrastructure, wage costs for existing and new services, as well as the province's new 1.7% employer health tax, which the city is required to pay. After a long day in chambers, analyzing and adding amendments to the $1.5 billion city budget, it passed, as did the $371 million capital budget for new projects. Council was able to reduce the property tax rate to 4.5% from the 4.9% originally proposed in the draft budget. The 0.4% reduction is something, but many property owners still feel it's too high. While on the flip side, some workers who are employed in city services and to build city infrastructure are happy with the property tax increase. Again, that's because a majority of the city's budget for doing everything a city does, like picking up trash, taking care of parks, building public amenities, this all comes from property tax. So while I was at City Council, I had a chance to speak with a property owner from Dunbar who was holding an anti-property tax increase sign. Also in the upper gallery of City Hall chambers was an individual holding a sign in support of the property tax increase. I was able to speak to both of them and get their thoughts. Let's take a listen to each interview. And first, here is a retired property owner living in Dunbar, and she preferred to remain anonymous. Like, what were you holding a sign in the gallery? Can you tell me what it said?
I don't think that the tax keep increasing is fair. I think they use our homeowner as a bank account to keep drawing money from us. Don't think homeowner are rich. We are not. We are struggling. The taxes keep increasing. We are struggling. Even we are considering a move out of the country, seriously, because we can't afford living here anymore. For myself, I have been in Vancouver since 1992. I love this country. I love this city. Now I feel like I'm going to be forced out. I don't know what this government doing. The provincial government is squeezing us for the school tax. They call that a school tax. I don't think anything related to school. They just find some excuses, a name for it. And I'm living in a neighborhood. There are a lot of retired people living in my surrounding. And they are living on fixed income. Including myself, we are just living on salary. The taxes keep increasing. Our salary is not increasing.
What about the fact that Vancouver pays some of the lowest property taxes in the country?
I don't think so. The tax doesn't matter what you compare with other things. It's all element in the package. Is the tax should relate to the income. Vancouver is not the highest income city, though. So you can't just compare with taxes. You have to compare all overall elements, including income and other expenses. Why don't we think about Vancouver's groceries quite expensive?
Right, so it's more the issue of taxing a property versus income.
Exactly. They all link to each other. So if you keep increasing the taxes, we are not only bearing the tax increase, also the, say, small business owner, they want to survive, they have to increase something or cut off their budget on something else. For example, they have to cut off some budget on hiring more people or reduce the quality of service. So ended up... there's a saying in Chinese, I can express it, I don't know how to say in English. Yang mao chu zai yang shen shang. If I translate into English, it could be the wool is from sheep's originally. Does it make sense to you? So the government keep increasing taxes. The ending is everyone's suffering. It's like a bad circulation, bad circle.
I'm wondering if property taxes went to, say, directly into, instead of going to the budget generally and operating costs, if they went directly into building affordable housing, like helping with the housing crisis specifically, would that make the tax more justifiable to you?
I haven't think that far because I'm not a politician. I'm not a politician, and I haven't really think for the politician, but just I come here today just presenting being a homeowner, and I know my neighborhood. If this all kind of taxes, including the school tax increased, and also today's discussing the multiple tax increase, I think I will lose my neighbors.
Do you mind telling me which neighborhood you live in?
Denver. Yes. People think Denver is rich, but I know, including myself, my friend house, my back alley house, left and the right, in five of us, four of us are retired people. Retired people. We're living on fixed retirement income.
Have you organized with other folks through the group Step Up?
No, I just presenting myself. So that's why I didn't prepare anything. I just being a homeowner, I want to speak out. Vancouver tax, I want to tell the governors, be careful. You touch one thing, the whole chain will be changed. The nature of the city will be changed. And really take our cheese away from our plate.
I'm just wondering, what would you say if someone said, if you own a property that's high in value, you could move to somewhere more affordable and pocket the sales money? What would you say to that?
Yes, some people saying that. I consider it. But that means I was living a peaceful life, well prepared for my raising children in this country. I love this country. I love this city. But all of a sudden, the outsider reasons will force me out of my plan. We reduce my life expectation and also my the quality of my life. So I'm being forced out. This is not fair. What's wrong with living in this neighborhood? We purchased a house in this neighborhood just because of closed-door work. It's not because of being prestigious. Why they squeeze us? The school tax is absolutely unfair, I would say. They just cover up everyone, whoever you are living in the, just luckily in the expensive house. They are not really targeting on the real problem. The real problem is not because of us. We live in this house for 20, 30, 50 years. It's not like we catch here for investment. This is the only house we have. It's not an investment house. We're not playing a game for buy and sell house for making money. No, this is our only nest.
What do you say about renters who are being renovicted or have no protection and are forced to move because of increasing rents and stuff? Do you empathize with them? Do you see your plight as being similar?
I'm not a landlord, so I really not thinking that far, that deep. I heard about that news. I haven't got a chance to investigate. Could be good reason, could be not. I have no idea about the rental market because I have been owning my house for decades and never leasing a house or rent a house from or to someone. So I'm not into that deep question yet.
It just strikes me as kind of similar in that everyone kind of wants to stay in their home, you know, and not be forced with increasing rents or property taxes or
yes.
whatever. So do you think people generally like have a right to stay in their home if they pay, you know, a reasonable amount either for rent or for tax?
There are some people say, hey, those retired people, they could delay their paying the tax for later. I would say that is not fair to tell people what you should leave, what you should change your retirement. I'm sure people before they get retired, they calculate how much budget for my each year and even they estimate how long they can live until. Some people say, maybe my health, I can live until 85 years old. So I budget my each year's income for each year's expenses. But now you all suddenly increase the expenses for them. The people have to shorten their life. If they can't shorten their life just by themselves, they have to move out and reduce their quality of life. And those people living in their house for 50 years, they already got used to this neighborhood, maybe for the reason easy to walk to grocery without driving, whatever, or their children not far away, they can look after them in their own home. So if you force them out to move to the suburb, it will cause another problem. They will be away from their own neighborhood, familiar with neighborhood, and also they'll be away from their children, old friends, old neighbors, and what hospital. So why are you disturbing their peaceful life? The politicians, the governors, their job should find the right target on, not everyone. You can't shoot everyone in the forest. You have to find the real predators.
So next we have Andrew Ledger. He's the president of QP1004. This union local comprises over 3,000 members. They include City of Vancouver workers, Park Board and Recreation workers, Portland Hotel Society employees, and a number of other groups. Andrew spoke with me about why he was at City Hall holding a sign in favor of property tax increases. So you were at City Hall yesterday when City Council was voting and asking questions about the 2019 budget. Can you tell me why you were there?
I was there. I'd made a presentation to Council a week prior, speaking to the budget and the important infrastructure spending that is being proposed in the upcoming budget. And I was there to hear what the different councillors' positions were and questions were surrounding the budget, because as the president of the local, I'm you know, actively interested and engaged in those questions.
Right. And I believe you had a sign. Do you mind telling me what it said?
I was inspired by the people sitting around me to write a sign. It said, taxes equal good public services. Which is my position, that taxes are a necessary component to municipalities being able to provide good public services. Mm-hmm. And I believe a majority of British Columbians and Vancouverites in particular, I think, share that opinion, you know, when it comes to things like making sure our roads are paved and our sewers and water infrastructure is properly maintained and expanded. You know, when it comes to things like public transportation, you know, I know the students at UBC are dependent upon, you know, those are all generated by citizens paying their taxes, and I think that that's a good thing.
Right, and taxes, specifically municipal taxes, go towards paying folks who are part of your union.
Yeah, they pay for all city workers, you know, firefighters, police officers, the parks employees, and city employees inside and outside. Yep, that's part of where those monies go.
Right. So I spoke with one of those protesters who were holding signs that said the opposite, which was the majority of protesters there. You may have been the only one who had a sign saying the opposite.
To be clear, I wasn't there as a protester. Mm-hmm. I just felt inspired to offer a different perspective on what was being debated because of the people surrounding me.
Yeah, the sign making was contagious. So you were expressing a different point of view, but I spoke with someone who had a sign that was anti-increasing the property tax that is now going to be set at 4.9%. And one of the things she said in explaining why she was opposed to that tax is that it's a tax on property rather than income. So she feels that it targets folks who don't actually have a high income, who may be retired, who aren't actually wealthy in terms of like cash in the bank. Do you think that that's a legitimate argument in terms of property tax, or do you feel that property tax is a fair way to get public services that we need paid for?
You know, an income tax is the most progressive form of taxation. However, the city of Vancouver doesn't have any other ability to tax the citizens of Vancouver. So it might not be perfect, but it's the system that we find ourselves in. And I think it's courageous of the city of Vancouver councillors and mayor to make the necessary tax increases to fund the public services that the citizens of Vancouver demand, right? Like that's the thing, is it's there we're dealing with a homelessness and a housing crisis. We're dealing with an opioid crisis. We're dealing with, you know, increased usage of our parks. And in order to deal with the growing demands of the citizens of Vancouver, we have to invest in the infrastructure to support our city. And with that comes tax increase. And a lot of that 4.9%, again, as was discussed yesterday, are things that are out of the city's control, such as parts of it go to the province, parts of it go to Metro as a region, and the city's percentage of what is actually part of that 4.9% is not the majority of it.
Yeah, there's the new health tax. It's like 1.7% the city also doesn't have control of. And that's a really good point, that property tax is one of the only avenues municipal governments have to generate any money. So I know during council yesterday, Pete Fry had suggested perhaps council and staff look into generating more revenue through fees, more fees, and maybe more permitting and stuff. Do you see that as like a viable alternative?
Well, I think for businesses, and I think that, you know, with the tax increases that were supported yesterday by council, there's also increased user fees that the city builds into almost every budget I've seen over the last 5 years that I've sort of been paying attention as the president of the local. So, you know, it's a way, but that will never generate enough revenue to be able to support the large capital investment that's needed and the core functioning of the city. User fees are just, it's not viable to generate enough money to pay for the city to operate.
Mm-hmm. Did you get a chance to speak with any of the folks holding signs up that were opposed to the property tax increase? Like, did you converse with that group at all?
No, I didn't. I was there really paying attention to what was being said by the councillors and the responses of staff. That was my sort of area of attention. And so, and the folks sitting around me weren't engaging with me, and I was doing other things, which was, paying attention to what was happening down below.
Fair. So are you happy the budget passed yesterday?
Yeah, I think it's the right thing to do. I think that there's a lot of good work that needs to get done, and I'm glad that the city will be able to move forward with the initiatives that are needed.
Great. Well, thanks for taking the time to chat with me, Andrew. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Take care.
Take care. Thank you for listening. Research and reporting by Gary Jarvis and myself, Alex DeBoer. Editing and production by Alex DeBoer. Our backing track was Time Waste by Vincent August. And we're ending the episode with a cover of Arthur Russell's A Little Lost by Pale Red.
I'm a little lost without you. That could be an understatement. Now I hope that I have paid the cost. Too late,
you're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We'll be back after this short break.
Will you help educate bright, very poor Kenyan youth to help them find a road out of poverty for their families? Just $50 a month will allow that to happen. Gifts of smaller amounts can be combined to give youth a chance through
CITR and Discord.
The Kenya...
I'm sorry? You can cover events and issues in the city and interview people, or you could join a collective and work with people with similar interests to make a show collaboratively. Maybe make a few friends.
Oh, wow, that sounds superb.
Totally. Just email volunteer at citr.ca and they can help you get started or just come into the station whenever.
Oh, I definitely will. Thank you so much.
It's not just rich people that own the media.
But by leaving out the most important things you need to know, they can elevate awareness to a new all-time low.
I own my media.
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 The Media Co-op is a grassroots national news network that's owned by its members.
But if it's just left out, can you say the paper lied? A lot of things that happened didn't happen after all. If there's no one in the forest who will put it in the news, I guess the tree didn't fall.
Join us today at mediacoop.ca/join.
I'm joining today. You should too.
So you're a member of CITR and Discorder, but are you a true friend?
Get a Friends of CITR and Discorder card for $20 for discounts around downtown at
Little Sisters Book and Art Emporium, Sakura's Classical Records, the Cinematheque, Vinyl Records, and the Fall Tattooing.
And we are back. This is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We just heard a story on Vancouver's property tax increase, which is part of the larger city budget, which passed on Tuesday, December 18th. So I understand that you both, Gary and Alex, were at City Hall on Tuesday covering the budget debate. So let's set the scene. What was City Hall like when you first arrived in the morning?
Okay, well, I arrived around about 9:30, and actually, there was a press conference actually taking place at that moment, and that was Kennedy Stewart, the mayor. He was talking, and on stage with him, just adjacent to Kennedy Stewart, was Sarah Blythe.
And who's Sarah Blythe?
Sarah Blythe is she's an emergency, I guess, frontline volunteer in the downtown east side.
She also ran for council this year as an independent.
Yeah, and I think she came in the top 20 of candidates. I mean, if we were to rank who got elected, Adrian Carr being number one, Sarah Blythe, I think she came in around about 18th, something like that. So Kennedy Stewart was speaking to the press, and there was, you know, quite a large turnout of press to hear or see the publication of the report that came out, which is report into the overdose emergency task force and the recommendations for immediate action on the overdose crisis. I mean, I have the report just here. I think what's important are the seven themes that were outlined for the immediate response. We can get more into the piece later, but just those seven themes were investments in Indigenous healing and wellness, support peer first responders to save lives, expanding harm reduction in the downtown east side, support clean supply, expand access to treatment supports outside of the downtown east side, harm reduction, treatment and supports, and finally collective action for systemic changes.
Interesting. So I didn't realize the budget debate started with a press conference. So besides that, I know one of the central focuses of the budget was on the proposed hike in property taxes, which we just learned a bit about in our first piece. But maybe tell me a bit about this anti-property tax crowd that was at City Hall, if you don't mind.
So when I got there, which was a bit after Gary, close to 9:45, the upper chambers of City Hall was mostly, not packed, but mostly filled with protesters or people holding signs that indicated they were opposed to the property tax increase that was set at a rate of 4.9% in the draft 2019 budget. So, I mean, it reminded me, I wasn't at council last week when the motion passed to send a letter to the provincial government to end the school tax, which is on basically a property tax on properties valued over $3 million. So it basically, like photos I saw from that day in council, it looked exactly the same to me. And some of the signs said the same things that I could read from the photos I saw, such as, like, you can't get blood from stone, one of my favorites. And things like that, basically, like, the tax is unfair.
Of the signs were like the same size. And basically,
The same size.
They've been, and then you were able to see on the reverse of the sign, they'd all been made from the same a local router. I'm not sure which one it was, but basically, yeah, it was on the reverse of like a router sign. So
totally.
I spoke to somebody on the steps of City Hall and had the opportunity to ask them, "Are you from like an organization?" And,
yeah,
and they said, "Oh yeah, we're part of the organization StepUp.ca," which, yeah, I think was they were. The group that was quite vocal around the school tax in City Hall last week.
Yeah, absolutely. That was my assumption as well, that everyone had been organized by Step Up. Step Up hasn't gotten a lot of press attention, but the group was found out by the Breaker reporter. What's his name?
Bob Mackin.
Yeah. So well done, Bob Mackin. Mainstream media isn't talking about this, really. So there's a group organized. It's like three men and a woman. They're, I can't remember, wealthy individuals who are opposed to property tax. You can check out The Breaker for more of their bios. I obviously can't recall. But anyway, and the woman I spoke with who was featured in the piece we just heard on property tax, she wanted to remain anonymous. She said she was not organized by Step Up, as we heard. So, you know, she said she was there on her own, yet she was holding a sign that was exactly the same size as all the other signs. Mm. So I think, like, I don't know, there was some organization there for sure. Maybe some individuals came out kind of like of their own accord, but
yeah, there was organization, because I even looked around and I watched, there was like a, you know, people were passing in and out like a relay almost. So some people would spend some time holding the sign, and then they would pass a sign to somebody else, and then the first person went on and got on with whatever they had to do the rest of the day.
So sort of saving face in a way. If someone has to leave, you get another person to replace them. You keep that presence up.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, keeping the presence up.
You don't give it up, which is very – that's an organized thing to do. Right?
Yes.
Yeah,
yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, so are we going to – Yeah, so you mentioned in your first story on property tax that Pete Fry suggested getting more revenue from fees. Tell me about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, so basically, like, we talk about, sorry, as I mentioned in the first piece on property tax, for those who don't realize, municipal governments actually get the majority of their funding from property taxes. So in Vancouver's case, it's 55% of the budget specifically. So that's most of their funding. The rest of the funding comes from fees and like permitting and stuff like that. So basically, Councillor Fry was saying, well, you know, if we want to keep property taxes down, but we still need to pay for X, Y, and Z in order to operate as a government, perhaps we could get more revenue from fees and permitting. So that was an interesting idea. I don't know how possible it is. And in the first piece we played, Andrew Ledger, QP 1004 president, said that he didn't think that it would be able to generate enough revenue. But I mean, that's one person's perspective. It doesn't seem like it was taken too seriously. But I mean, really, that's the thing to keep in mind, is that municipal governments really only have a few options for generating revenue. And I think that was one of the issues. Well, I know that was one of the issues with the school tax, and one of the reasons why, say, for example, Councillor Pete Fry said he voted to send a letter to the provincial government asking them to revoke the school tax, because it's basically a property tax, right? And so if people are paying, and by people, I mean people with properties over $3 million, if they're paying an amount of tax to the provincial government, and then they also have to go and pay a property tax to their local government, they're not going to be as happy, and it makes the city look worse when they up their property tax, right? So, just interesting to consider.
Yeah, it certainly is. So I was following Twitter, and at about 11:40 a.m., you, meaning the News Collective, tweeted councillor Jeans Swanson wants to know how much the city spends on homelessness in various forms, i.e. park rangers, policing, so that it can be confirmed that it is in fact cheaper to end homelessness than to allow it to continue. Could you guys talk about that for a little bit?
Well, it's interesting you mention Gene, and this is a slight aside, but whilst I was there observing what was going on in the council chambers, actually one of the protesters who was holding up the signs actually approached me and tapped me on the shoulder and asked if I was with the media. I replied that I was, and then said to me, "Do you see that person down there knitting? That's where our tax dollars go." I was kind of taken aback. I wasn't sure what to say.
And she was speaking about Jean Swanson, who notoriously is always knitting.
Yes, being doubly productive.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is
doing
true.
Her job and pursuing a hobby.
And producing scarves.
Yes.
Yep.
That is like, she is neoliberal. She's the most neoliberal counselor in a way. I'm sorry, she'd be so offended by that. But, you know, being highly productive, that is.
Yes. It was a lovely scarf from what I could see looking down from the upper gallery. I didn't know what to say. I just responded to the person who'd said those words to me and said, "I'm sorry, I'm working." And then I was able to just leave it off there at that point.
How interesting, though, that some people come to council, see these counselors in front of them or below them working, and one of them is knitting, and they say that's where our tax dollars are going. I will say, from being at council a number of times and making, like, looking out on that same council, people are on their phones most of the time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, Dijanova's, like, texting. Like, or whatever. She's probably doing other things, too. But, like, people, it's either they're on their phones, they might be paying attention for a little bit, they're on their computer, or Jean's knitting. So it's, like, it's not like everyone is, like, making eye contact, and then Jean is just, like, whatever, I'm just knitting. Yeah. Don't even know what's
they're
up.
They're not sitting there with their arms folded, looking at each other while they're speaking.
And council was in session from, like, 9:30 to like 10 p.m. on Tuesday. Yeah. So
that's right.
That's a long time. I mean, there were a few breaks, but.
Yes, a long day. And I've experienced this in another forum where I've seen somebody knitting, not Jean, but somebody else knitting in a meeting. And but I'm always blown away. That person's knitting, but they come out with the most amazing questions.
Well, and I mean, it can help your concentration when you're doing something with your hands. Yeah. I used to, like, weave when I would do other things, like listen to podcasts or whatever. I don't know. It helps me focus sometimes to do something with my hands.
Yep.
But anyway, let's move on from that. Where were we even at? Oh, yeah. So Jean's back to where we began, which was Jean asked city staff to, you know, take some time, because they had just put a lot of work into composing this budget. But when they had time after the break to try to add up exactly how much the city spends to manage homelessness. So, like, park rangers, you know, moving homeless folks around, cleaning up, like, tents where people may have lived, cleaning up needles, doing things like that. And basically her argument is that, like, rationally speaking, she thinks it'll be proven quite simply that the city spends more on managing homelessness than it would cost to end it, which I think is probably just, like, fiscally correct. But we'll see. Throughout this whole budget discussion, one thing that came up, like, pretty early on and continued to be a trend throughout the day was that NPA counselors, particularly the new NPA counselors, which is there's five in total. One of them is an incumbent, Melissa Dijanova, and the other four are new. So the new ones, which is Hardwick, Kirby Young, Dominato, and what's the other one?
Kirby Young?
No, Hardwick, Dominato, Kirby Young, and one is escaping me. But anyway, the four of them, we're basically pushing a lot to reduce the budget, which is to be expected. The NPA is our right of center party. And so that continued, or that began right away. So we tweeted, you know, around noon, a little before, that Councillor Hardwick wanted justification for spending, which was allotted in the budget for new hires, especially for engineering. A lot of the budget, or a significant amount of the budget, went to hiring engineering staff. So she was wondering if instead employees could be reallocated. So yeah, you saw that coming up, you know, asking questions about how basically the budget could be tightened. And then also something that came up at the beginning of the debate, which was interesting, that Gary and I both noted, was that MPA counselors were talking about whether it would be possible to sort of charge other municipalities, such as like for our police force. They brought up how, you know, people from the suburbs come into the city to like go to hockey games and maybe go to the Granville Strip to party. And so our police force is going towards policing them. So shouldn't they front some of the bill?
Yeah. And there was a question from Councillor Bly.
Actually, Bly, that's the fourth one.
She was mentioning immediately that could there not be some cost recovery? And Andrew Palmer of the Vancouver Police Department said, you know, basically it was an impossibility.
And like they brought up the Vancouver
riots. Yeah. Andrew Palmer referenced the Stanley Cup riot.
Yeah, it was Councillor Blyde who said at around 10:45 a.m. that most of them were from Surrey.
Yes, indeed, which is true.
Yeah. objectively, yeah. If you look into it, there are social media accounts like, riot tonight, headed out to Vancouver. Like, yeah, like that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure there were a lot of Vancouverites involved, too.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah. Right, so there was basically there was a lot of searching for ways to make other people pay for our budget.
Right. So before the lunch break happened, the Greens asked staff to look into how much climate change was affecting the city.
Yeah. So basically that was Councillor Fry. So because they're talking about, you know, various parts of the budget include, you know, little things that are part of dealing with climate change, like mitigating like rising water and such. Mm. I forget a lot of the specifics, but basically Councillor Fry posed this to staff, and then city manager Sadu Johnson said they could probably figure that out, but they'd have to go into an in-camera session and kind of crunch some numbers. So basically, there was a lunch break around 12:30, I think. And then people had a chance to eat. And then from 2 to 3, there was an in-camera session to discuss the amount the city was spending on dealing with climate change. Yeah, so we all took a break. And I did return at 3. There were far less people there. All the protesters were gone.
I was gone.
Gary was gone. So I came back and basically right away, so this is 3 p.m., one of the first, if not the first, motion to be tabled regarding the budget was by Councillor Adrian Carr of the Green Party. She tabled a motion called Bolder Climate Action. And, you know, folks around the table talked about, councillors all spoke on how, you know, this is important. And it passed unanimously. So Councillor Carr was pleased about that. She sort of said so after when she came by the media table. And basically it includes recommendations for ways to deal with climate change. I don't have the specifics in front of me, but that seemed like an important amendment to be added to the budget.
Indeed. I'd really like to get into what also happened after the break, which was Kirby Young tabling a few motions, three. The most important one had to be a motion she tabled to defer the budget until the first quarter of 2019. This would be to allow time to better evaluate the budget.
Right. And also, sorry, just to go back for a sec, for the Boulder Climate motion that Adrian Carr passed, more specifically, what it does is direct $5 million from emerging priorities capital funding, which is like a section in the budget, a line in the budget, and instead directs that money into climate action measures. So just to give a better sense of that. So then, sorry, you were saying...
Yeah, so I was talking about Kirby Young's motions, the three that she tabled, and what I think is the most important one, which was to defer the budget until the first quarter of 2019.
Yeah, totally. That was really interesting because, Kirby Young had a few motions. And so one of them which I think people were pretty surprised about. So, like, a lot of the motions counselors put forward, actually the vast majority, they've already talked to each other about. So this one, Kirby Young kind of surprised people with. And I know, like, Counselor Fry came by the media table and was like, oh, I didn't see this coming. And so people were a little surprised. And I think it warranted like a 10-minute break for people to absorb it. But basically, she asked for the budget to be deferred for further consideration. This was part of a lot of rhetoric from the new NPA counselors who mentioned repeatedly, like, basically how they wanted a fresh start from the previous council. They were elected to bring change. And this budget was brought forward from the previous council. And so they were inheriting it rather than having designed it themselves. So in response to these sentiments expressed by Kirby Young as well as Hardwick, she commented on this. Other counselors like Pete Fry, Adrian Carr, and even Melissa DeGenova, the incumbent NPA counselor, said that, you know, in fact, if we defer the budget, it's just going to take longer. We're wasting time. Like, let's just get on with it.
That's probably the experience of being a counselor.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So basically, both Adrian Carr and Melissa DeGenova made these points. And Melissa DeGenova said, like, we're sitting here in council and there's two incumbents here, her and Adrian Carr. And having been through this process, she just felt it made more sense to just go forward. No, go ahead.
All right. So, and what this meant is everyone in the MPA except for Melissa DeGenova, they were the only people to vote for it. So all outside counselors of the MPA and everyone else. So it lost, basically.
Correct.
They didn't have a majority on this. And if it had passed, let's just get into the hypothetical, it would have been to reduce the property tax rate by 1%.
Yeah, exactly.
3.9, right?
So that was, yeah. And you could really see, like, Kirby Young trying to, you know, appeal to her, who voted for her, just like everyone was doing. You know, that's what counselors do. But, you know, she had been elected as a right of center candidate, and, like, you know, making the budget smaller was one of the things people wanted her to do, and she was trying to do it, and it did not work. And it was very interesting to see Melissa DeGenova vote against it.
Maybe she has some, I mean, she mentioned that she had to step out of the room for some parts of the agenda because she had the conflict of interest. Mm-hmm. And so perhaps some of the things that were of concern to her and why we should pass the budget or why the budget should be passed, funding of the police.
Well, Kirby Young is also married to a police officer.
Oh, okay.
Or someone in the police. But yeah, I mean, just to close up this section of our conversation, I will say that, like, the final comment Kirby Young made before the council voted on this motion, which ultimately failed, was that what she was trying to do is bring affordability to the city. She used the word affordability. And I thought that was interesting because she was talking about, and she specifically mentioned people like 19 to 39 or something. I believe that was the range she gave. And she said that young people are struggling to live in the city, and that's why she's trying to reduce property tax, which is interesting because we're talking about class here, right? Like, we're talking about a class of young people who are thinking about buying property. That's a very wealthy class,
yes.
which is fine. Like, that's, or I mean, you know.
Well, it's fine that they are class, of course.
Yeah.
Is it the majority of 19 to...
Exactly.
Yeah, like, I mean, no, it simply is not. As a person in that demographic who speaks to many people in that demographic constantly, it's just not the case. I know my anecdotes aren't facts, but I mean, I live in this city, and I would say that certainly most of us are not considering our first home at this point.
Exactly, yeah. So it's just like, it's a minority. So that was interesting. Yeah. But let's move on to Councillor Swanson's motions.
Yeah, so she had a few socially progressive motions, which is entirely in character, such as simply not increasing the police budget, which, if increased, would receive $5.4 million in new initiatives, which would be taking $3 million out of the general budget, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. So basically, Swanson, although it's been mischaracterized by media a number of times, she wasn't voting to reduce the budget. She's voting to just keep it the same, just not put more into it. Mm. So,
yeah, that bears mentioning for sure.
Yeah, totally. So she basically said she put a motion forward asking for the budget to stay the same. You know, folks like Adrian Carr was like, yeah, I totally get what you're saying, but like, it's just not realistic is my summary. One city councilor, Christine Boyle, said that she would support it and that she is equally concerned with the, and I quote, criminalization of poverty, although she has no illusions that this will pass in council, which she was right, it did not. And after that, Kirby Young actually, this was an interesting moment for me, Kirby Young objected to the use of the phrase criminalization of poverty. And she said that she sees this type of language as divisive and vilifying police officers, which is really interesting. And again, I believe she is married to someone in the police force.
Yeah, I'm interested in hearing Jean's responses to those comments.
Yeah, let's take a listen.
Time for us to send a message that we need to spend money on social programs addressing the issues and not policing them. Some of you have talked about the ride-alongs that you went on. Well, I could get some folks to take you on a walk-along. I've actually been on lots of walk-alongs for the last 12 years, and you can see it for your own self, that often Indigenous people are targeted by the police, and that there is profiling and that there is harassment. So anyway, this motion is just a plea. An attempt to raise an important issue that we need to deal with two things. We need to start solving social problems at the root and not policing them. And we need to stop harassment and profiling that does happen. So thanks for just listening to this, and I hope we can get on with actually solving the problems.
Thank you very much, Councillor Swanson. No more speakers on the queue, so we'll call the vote on this. And everyone's voted. This amendment has failed. Councillor Kirby Young, Bly, Domenico, Weave, Hardwick, Fry, Dejanova, Carr, and me in opposition.
Yeah, right. So that clip, and I hope you could hear that, she said she had gone on walk-alongs in Vancouver, you know, to see racial discrimination and targeting of vendors. So there were definitely some clear political lines being drawn up in council chambers at that point.
Right. So, yeah, definitely. Basically, the reason she was talking about walk-alongs was like a response to how some counselors had been saying, you know, I've gone in ride-alongs with police, which is a thing that counselors do. They like go with police and they go out on like emergency calls, and then they say like, oh my God, this is such an intense job. Like, you're seeing all these overdoses and stuff, and like, it's true. But then like Jean's saying, how about you try like looking at things from the opposite side, which is the side of people who are on the street, who are experiencing those overdoses, who are experiencing the police coming to them either to help or perhaps, you know, to ask them to move along. Maybe they've set up like a vending area and they're not allowed to, whatever. So, yeah. And Gary, you noticed that language being used to this morning in a questioning period at City Hall, like Dejanova used this walk-along phrase.
Yeah, she actually used that. Yeah, just to mention that with her time and her experience of doing walk-alongs with Philip Owen in the past, and her experience of knowing what things are like on the ground.
Yeah, I wonder if Jean just started and like coined a new phrase. Did that exist before?
I don't know if it existed before. I mean, I do know from my time in living in the city, and for a long time I did actually live in the downtown east side, is the perspective that you have when you drive a car through the downtown east side is very different from the perspective of a pedestrian walking through the downtown east side. as a pedestrian for years walking through the downtown east side felt completely comfortable and completely safe. But being in a car driving through the downtown east side was I found a totally different experience. Just
definitely.
A little bit nerve-wracking.
Definitely. So I'm just conscious of time. Gary, we wanted to end off this show, Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM, in case you're just tuning in, with your observations on a sort of press conference slash question period that took place this morning at City Hall. You weren't able to attend, but you did listen to the live stream. And if you want to just tell us a bit about what was happening at City Hall this morning.
Well, basically, the emergency task force report basically came out. It was published today. There was a press release on Tuesday, but today was an opportunity for first responders, volunteers, and also emergency personnel to have an opportunity to speak to council and then take questions from councillors. I found the dialogue and conversation between Sarah Blythe and Pete Fry extremely interesting. They had a lot of good things to say to each other, and a lot of great questions came from Pete Fry to Sarah Blythe.
Right. And then you had a clip?
Yeah.
All right, so let's take a listen to a clip. This is, as Gary said, Councillor Pete Fry speaking with Downtown Eastside opioid...
Frontline
worker, yeah. Sarah Blythe. So let's take a listen.
Sarah Blythe,
thank you.
On the success of like replacement type therapies and managed treatment like that?
Yeah, absolutely. I've worked in the Downtown East Side for over 12 years. I've worked in shelters. I worked at InSight when it was busy and there was no other overdose prevention sites. I've met people in social housing and they've been on the Crosstown program, which is a maintenance program, so safe supply. And it really literally changes people's lives overnight to have a safe supply. They're not having to do survival sex trade, survival drug dealing. They're not having to break into people's cars. All the firefighters, frontline workers, you know, anyone who works in the Downtown East Side understands that this is a huge piece of what needs to happen, especially in the Downtown East Side, where people are already using drugs. A lot of people have pain, they have trauma, there's other things going on that they need, they cannot completely get off drugs altogether, and so they need something, right? So long-term cancer, it may be hard to understand for some, but it's...
So how many people are in the Crosstown program?
I think it's around 100 people, but we need to scale it up. So, you know, I think we could, you know, easily get 1,000 people or more in a program. If we did that immediately, that would be, you know, saving people's lives immediately. That would be a huge, huge benefit. Both fiscally and just because, you know, breaking into cars, going to the hospital, being, you know, because of ambulance rides, all of those things cost a lot of money. This crisis costs us a lot of money just to keep going every day. And so, you know, honestly, you guys are going to have to ask you guys to do things that I did and be brave and strong and do things like unconventionally. And say this is the right thing and not look at it, oh, how is this going to be politically for me? You're going to say, this has to be done. It makes the most sense. We're hearing this from the frontline workers and we're going to do it. And it's going to be fun.
All right. So that was Sarah Blythe.
Yeah, that was Sarah Blythe. And she's on the front line. She's basically experiencing what's going on. She was motivated to get active in the Downtown East Side after like experiencing a death of somebody, a relative of somebody she knew. And I think so basically what she's calling on council is like, you've come out with these recommendations, now you need to act on them.
Right. Exactly. So we are going to conclude this episode because we are over time. So thank you so much for listening. This is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We from the News Collective wish you happy holidays. And wanted to remind you to be sure to subscribe to our podcast, Seeking Office, which is in its second season, called At Large. Yeah. It has been confusing. I have been very confusing about this. I was going to rename it, and then it was like, no, we already have it. Like, it's already on the podcast feed as Seeking Office. So it is remaining called Seeking Office, but the season, season two post-election, is called At Large.
Maybe we should call them parts, you know?
Whatever, dude. Whatever. Okay. So thanks for listening. Tune in again next Thursday at 5 p.m. And happy holidays.